This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Support for the world comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
Thousands of children were separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. An attorney is dealing with it, one family at a time.
Her mission is to locate a father. She has some clues, his name and where he might live.
The difficult task of reunification. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the former president of Liberia warns of vaccine apartheid if richer countries don't view COVID as a global problem.
If they do not respond to the needs in Africa so that everyone has access, they will also not be safe.
And a musician from Belgium working to preserve the history and music of his Roma culture.
The violin was starting to become a bit extinct. There was only guitars. I found that a pity.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us today. It has been more than 3 years since the Trump administration began separating families at the U.S.-Mexico border. Officials said their so-called zero-tolerance policies would deter migration. Critics call what happened a national shame. More than 5,500 children were separated from their parents. Many have been reunited. Hundreds remain apart. This week, President Joe Biden announced a task force to reunite families. Some people have already been doing this work, scouring parts of Central America, searching for parents.
Hola, buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Dora Isabel Melara. Soy abogada.
People like Dora Melara, a lawyer in Honduras. KQED reporter Michelle Wiley has our story.
It's 5 a.m. in San Pedro Sula, Honduras, and Dora Melara is already awake. She's getting ready for a long drive, 4 hours in the pouring rain.
Ya tenemos lista la documentación, maletas.
She packs light, some important documents, and sandwiches for the road in an overnight bag. Her mission is to locate a father. She has some clues, his name and where he might live. She knows he was separated from his teenage son at the U.S. border in 2018 and deported without him. Dora, a lawyer in her 40s, is working with Justice in Motion, a U.S. nonprofit. Its goal is to connect with deported parents, to see if they've reunited with their kids, or if they're still separated, do they know where their kids are? And to let them know they have options. Perhaps they can now return to the U.S. with legal status. She's never sure she'll find the parent she's looking for, but she's hopeful.
Pero esperamos encontrarles y bueno, que el camino esté bonito.
Over WhatsApp, Dora shared videos and photos of her journey, and she's led more than 36 quests like this. Many are successful. She searched for parents during the pandemic, navigating curfews. She's making this trip after deadly hurricanes have pummeled the area, displacing at least 150,000 people. Just 2 hours into the drive, Dora counts 4 rock slides. She spots homemade signs, warning about the damage. She's with a colleague and they maneuver their Ford Escape around deep potholes. During these searches, Dora often relies on the kindness of strangers to point her toward the parent she's looking for. She arrives to the first town in the mountains where the father might live. Dora hopes things move quickly. Driving in the area will be dangerous after dark. But she gets word that the father isn't there. He might live in another town, 40 minutes away, she's told. So it's back in the car. She arrives and is told, nope, the father doesn't live there either.
Nos tocará quedarnos hoy acá debido al clima.
She'll have to stay the night, she says. The rain is coming down hard. One of Dora's videos shows a thick fog. The next day, she hits the road to the third town in 2 days. And then, a miracle.
Ya tenemos la dirección del señor.
Someone knows where the father lives, she says. We got his address. Dora takes a video as they drive into his town. Tiny wooden homes and palm trees line a narrow dirt road. Dora's excited to be so close, but the father's home is up a steep, muddy road. She ditches her car to walk the last stretch.
Aquí vamos.
And it's pretty tiring. There's a cluster of small homes. A boy greets her and asks what she's doing there. She tells him who she's looking for, and then the father steps out of one of the homes. Just like that, Dora's search is over.
No sabía, él estaba completamente ignorante de que nosotros le estábamos buscando.
Dora says the father has no idea that anyone was looking for him. He invites her in to sit. Dora explains why she's there and what his options are. She asks if he knows where his teenage son is at.
Tiene una idea de dónde está su hijo, pero no tiene una comunicación con él.
She says he has an idea of where his son might be in the U.S., but they haven't been in touch. Dora has to be careful about what she reveals about the father's circumstances, because these conversations are confidential. They talk more, exchange information. She hopes they'll stay in touch. A few days later, Dora reflects on what parents have told her about being turned back at the U.S.-Mexico border without their children. She says some people feel shame.
Yo sentí deseo de no volver a mi tierra. Yo sentí vergüenza en ver a mi esposa y saber que me lleve mi hijo y regreso sin él.
Some parents don't want to go home at all, to face their spouse without their child. Even if she can't change anything right away, Dora says meeting the parents, listening to them, can be meaningful.
Hay alguien que se está interesando en mí.
She says when they talk, parents know that someone cares about them and their children. Perhaps it brings them some hope and acknowledgement of what happened to them, so they feel less alone. For The World, I'm Michelle Wiley in San Diego.
Tomorrow, we hear from a father who was separated from his son at the border and how lawyers like Dora Malata are trying to help him. At the International Criminal Court in The Hague today, a guilty verdict was handed down for a former child soldier in Africa. Dominic Ongwen was a commander in the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda. The rebel group led a brutal campaign of terror in parts of Central Africa for 30 years. The ICC found Ongwen guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Joining me from New York to talk about this is Elise Kepler. She's the Associate Director of the International Justice Division at Human Rights Watch. So the crimes Ongwen has been convicted of are murder, rape, enslavement, torture, very serious stuff. Who is Ongwen and what role did he play in the atrocities in northern Uganda?
Ongwen himself began as a victim of the Lord's Resistance Army, abducted into LRA forces, but he later went on to become a powerful commander and rise up the ranks. He was one of five individuals charged by the International Criminal Court, including Joseph Kony, the leader of the group and founder, and three others who have since been declared or presumed dead.
And Joseph Kony, the notorious Joseph Kony, he's still at large, correct?
He is at large, but his whereabouts are believed to be known. There's an organization, Invisible Children, which tracks the LRA movements, and he's believed to be at an area known as Kafia Kingi, which is on the border of Sudan and South Sudan. From our perspective, this verdict is a reminder that Kony remains a fugitive and does need to be arrested and surrendered to face charges at the ICC.
Ongwen is the first leader of the Lord's Resistance Army to be convicted by the ICC. How significant is his guilty verdict, and what do you think it means for Joseph Kony?
It should be a wake-up call for perpetrators, would-be perpetrators in Central Africa, but also around the world. Justice has been slow and hard to achieve in many respects, but it can and does happen. And for victims to finally have a chance to see some justice for these crimes is a huge step forward.
Elise, at the center of this case really is a complicated question because Ongwen himself was kidnapped and forced to become a child soldier at a young age. He is a perpetrator, no doubt, but as you said earlier, also a victim. How did the court grapple with that?
The court was clear that they do see his status as a victim himself as relevant, and that his status as a child victim does not negate his culpability for the crimes. And the court, the judges were clear to emphasize that he was a fully responsible adult at the time the charges he's convicted of were committed. You know, I think this is a reflection of the complexity of this conflict. There were so many children who suffered at the hands of the Lord's Resistance Army. You know, a massive amount, some 30,000 children were abducted by the Lord's Resistance Army. And you can find these situations where people are both victims and perpetrators.
One interesting detail, the proceedings in The Hague were broadcast in communities that had been affected by the LRA in northern Uganda. Do we have any idea of how the verdict is being received there?
Not surprisingly, there are a variety of views. You know, some feel he should be forgiven as a former victim. Some feel he should be in jail for an extremely long period. But I think the key is not to try to define what, you know, what people's reactions should be. The role of outreach is not to define how people should think and feel, but make sure that they have enough information to fully take in what's happened. And that's why these outreach activities, the video screenings that are live streams that are happening in northern Uganda today, there's also an event in Ongwen's hometown, are really important so that people can wrestle with and fully comprehend what this process is to try and assure justice for victims of the crimes.
Elise Kepler is the Associate Director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch, speaking with us about the first leader of the Lord's Resistance Army to be convicted by the ICC. He's a former child soldier. Elise joined us from New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Some major foreign policy news from the White House today. The U.S. is ending its support for Saudi Arabia's military offensive in Yemen. Yemen, as you know, has been engulfed in a civil war for more than 6 years. Nabil Nowera is an independent political analyst whose expertise is in the Gulf region. How big a deal is this, Nabil, the Biden administration pulling its support for Saudi Arabia?
Well, first of all, we need to understand that today is the end of the U.S. support for the offensive operations. So from that, the first takeout is that the U.S. has been supporting the offensive operations in Yemen for about 6 years. So today, that will be the end of it, hopefully. The second, I think, takeaway is that this is only for the offensive operations, which means that the United States will still support Saudi Arabia, maybe in defensive or other operations regarding the war in Yemen. Today, I think, is a big decision by the new U.S. administration. And I think this will increase the pressure on the Saudi Arabia on its attempts to end the war in Yemen. I think it's a matter of time when we will see the Yemeni parties, the conflict will come around on the negotiation table and try to reach a solution, a peaceful solution to this war, and hopefully end the whole military intervention in Yemen.
And what do you think could be the immediate impact of this news on the ground? I mean, first steps before peace actually breaks out.
I think that we will not see any immediate impact on the ground because this is more on the diplomatic level. As I said, it will increase the pressure on Saudi Arabia and its coalition to bring this war to an end.
Nabil, we should remember that it was the Obama White House that originally greenlighted the Saudi-led offensive in Yemen. Why do you think the Biden administration chose to go this route?
This is a very good point. And when Obama was the president, Joe Biden was the vice president. But I think the conditions now are different. Everybody understands that the war in Yemen has very devastating impacts on the Yemeni people with no success of any means for the Saudi-led coalition or even the other parties, including the Houthis or, you know, other Yemeni parties.
How do you think this could change the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia? I mean, what will Saudi make of this withdrawal of support?
Well, I think we need to understand that Saudi Arabia wants out of Yemen. The U.S.-Saudi relationship is kind of maybe disturbed in some way, but also they, I think the two countries enjoy very strong partnerships on different fields. And I think this will eventually actually help Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been wanting to go out of this war for a long time, but just waiting for a face-saving factor to get her out of Yemen. Maybe Saudi Arabia will be a little bit angry, maybe because it's not maybe consulted within this decision. But eventually, I think it will be helpful for Saudi Arabia. there should be a factor that will bring this war to an end. And if this will help Saudi Arabia take the decision to go out of Yemen and also to pressure the parties it supports in Yemen to go to the negotiation table, I guess this will be, by the end of the day, for the interest of Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and of course, to Yemeni people.
Nabil Noera is an independent analyst of the Gulf region. Nabil, thanks very much for your thoughts on this.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a musical composition that explores how we remember deep loss. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. An ambitious musical composition was scheduled to premiere this month in Europe called I Silenti, The Silent Ones. The title refers to a harrowing and lesser-known story of the Holocaust in Europe during World War II. Like so much performance this past year, I Silenti was postponed indefinitely because of the pandemic. But we're able to hear the music and bring it to you. Reporter Emily Pons has a story of I Silenti and the Belgian musician who plays a central role.
Chalimberger was raised by musicians in Northern Europe.
There were always musicians coming by and people showing instruments and wanting my dad's advice about this or that, or just coming to rehearse or just coming to hang out.
Limberger was born blind, and so while the other kids were playing soccer, he was at home teaching himself how to play music.
And I started to play all kinds of flutes and percussions and instruments from all over the world, actually, anything I could lay my hands on.
Following the Roma tradition of his family, Limberger ended up playing manouche, a kind of European jazz.
And then when I was 17, I picked up the violin because I noticed that in the manouche community, the violin was starting to become a bit extinct. There was only guitars. And I found that a pity.
Chalimberger now lives in San Sebastian, Spain, and is known as one of the most versatile and gifted musicians currently living in Europe. He plays traditional music from Greece, Turkey, Bulgaria, Romania, and he also plays jazz. His latest project is called I Silenti. It mixes opera, theater, and dance. This new work by Belgian saxophonist Fabrizio Cassol is about giving a voice to those who have not had one. It refers to the Romani genocide, part of the Holocaust that is sometimes overlooked, in which hundreds of thousands of Roma people died. Italian Renaissance composer Monteverdi wrote the madrigals I Silenti is based on. One of the defining characteristics is the use of counterpoint, a variety of melodic lines happening all at once. This technique is a way in I Silenti to restore and capture the plurality of voices silenced by the tragic events of the Holocaust in Europe.
I Silenti is in a way talking about this whole thing about disappearing and origin. you know, because Isilenti in a way refers to the gypsy people who, in contrast to Jewish people have learned to talk about the Holocaust, whereas gypsies haven't. Our word for yesterday and tomorrow is the one and the same word. In our dialect, it's taisa. And the only way you can know if it's yesterday or tomorrow is by the conjugation of the verb, whether it's in past tense or present. We don't even have a future tense, really.
Limburger uses the word gypsy to refer to his community. Some find that term offensive and use Roma instead. This is Limburger's take on why this past is sometimes forgotten.
Because there's misery. People were poor and they were just struggling to survive. And then there's this Second World War with all the traumatic experiences of concentration camps and all that. And you don't want to remember that. You just want to forget it. And so Isilenti, in a way, are like the madrigals that Fabrizio chose from Monteverdi. You could read this poetry as if it were letters written by gypsies in those days, which they never wrote.
The Roma have an impressive oral tradition. A song from Limburger's family became part of Isilenti. Meshu Nova was most likely written by Limburger's great uncle and was memorized from generation to generation.
And the lyrics of the song are very simple. They say, it goes as follows. I hear, or I listen, that's the same verb. I hear the little river in the forest. I see the flowers that are fading. Good God, give me the opportunity to see my people once again. That's all. It's a powerful song.
Limburger was scheduled to play at Carnegie Hall for the first time in April. It's not clear whether that will happen yet, but he's not letting that bother him. He's keeping busy playing music while taking care of a new baby. For The World, I'm Emily Pons.
You're listening to The World. One way to fight climate change, plant more trees. Problem is, managing forests to combat global warming has not always worked out so well. In Eastern Canada, they're trying a different approach, simply giving a very high value to trees.
You know, we're not churchgoers by any means, but our church is the woods.
That's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. I don't have to tell you, it's a strange, confusing, and difficult time. For nearly a year, we've been watching the death toll from this global pandemic grow. now at 2.25 million worldwide. At the same time, new vaccines seem nothing short of miraculous, a tantalizing tomorrow of not living in constant anxiety. So how do we process grief and also embrace a realistic amount of hope? For some advice, we reached out to surgeon, writer, and researcher Dr. Atul Gawande. He's the author of Being Mortal, Medicine, and What Matters in the End. These seem to me like one of the honest moments of the pandemic. We've just come off some record-breaking weeks of deaths and illnesses, and yet for the first time, there's a real possibility for some relief ahead. We also have people who are following the risk mitigation guidelines, many who are not. How are you trying to make sense of the contradictions right now?
Well, I'm not sure it's that contradictory to me. When one of the things I track very closely is face mask usage, and it was down in the 60% range in places like the Mountain West, where cases were exploding in September. That's up at 85-90%. That's the United States, but that's also the story in Europe, where face mask usage and limits on capacity and just people not gathering the same way we did 3 months ago, that has also changed. You go to India, where in September it was on its way to being the number one, having the number one highest rates of spread of COVID in the world. And now it has among the lowest because they got mask use up to 99% in major cities. So, you know, you see people responding to the growth in cases in ways that, you know, people are starting to follow the science.
So despite 2.25 million deaths around the globe, Dr. Gawande, I sense some optimism in your voice.
I do have optimism. The basic tools have been the same, and when we use them, they work. We have major challenges ahead of us. We have mutant strains that are spreading in from South Africa, from Britain, from Brazil, and in some cases have a weaker cause vaccines to have a weaker effect. We have vaccines rolling out, so we're in a race to get ahead of the virus and the mutants. But I think we've got the tools in front of us plus the vaccines. We can get out of it. It's always about us humans.
I mean, just getting by each day, though, requires so much kind of compartmentalizing of horror, putting in a box, trying to take care of oneself and one's family. I know the new vaccines help, but as you say, along come the worries about what mutations might bring. What is it like for you moving from day to day? Are you holding your breath about what the virus is going to do next?
You know, we have consistently underestimated this virus, and at every step of the way, we have overpromised and underdelivered. And so my faith that we will prevail is never going to be unclouded by the reality of the brutal facts of where we've been and how difficult it's been to pull together as communities to make the right things happen. This is always the challenge. When it's terrible, we respond. And then it starts coming down and we start seeing that things are better and keeping our foot on the pedal long enough to get it so that it actually is stopped rather than just going to rebound again. That's our challenge over and over and over again.
Do you find when you're talking to your colleagues and contacts in other parts of the world that there's a bit of a disconnect? Like here in the U.S., the virus is just raging. Other countries may have a better grip on things. But is this very traumatic moment universal?
It is largely universal. You know, there was a time when Europe could gloat and say, what the hell is wrong with America? And then they became the highest spread right up there with the United States spread. You have India and my colleagues there wondering what's going on here, but there was a time when they were terrible. There are parts of the world that have got it right in the beginning and continue to get it right, places like Australia and New Zealand, and also throw in Vietnam, Thailand. Those have been the exceptions. Much of the world has been hit at one point or another and been behind the eight ball.
Even with vaccines, Dr. Gawande, we're going to be facing outsized levels of death and downward spiraling economies going forward. I mean, the anti-grief advice I kind of give myself each day, just put one foot in front of the other, give my family more hugs and kisses than usual. Generally, it seems to be working, but there are days when I get up and I am just miserable. I realize I haven't seen friends. I miss physical contact. And I know I'm not alone. I also know I'm in a pretty privileged position. What do you tell people who are out of a job, who have lost loved ones?
There's there's no way to salve the hurt. It is there, and the damage is real. The main thing is that I have total confidence that we will prevail. We have warmer weather coming. We have these vaccines. And we know the things that do work that allow you to start reconnecting again, including face masks and soon vaccines. So, you know, it is just brutal. Life has changed in ways that were unfathomable this time last year. And I desperately miss all of the things you described, plus concerts, plus, you know, hanging out in a bar. And I'm so ready for that to come back. And I know we're going to get there, and that it's a long time away.
Concerts and going to a bar. Yeah, I'm feeling that. Do you think the pandemic has maybe normalized death for some people, made it less taboo to discuss? And is that an upside?
I don't think we became inured to death. I think we all have gotten to live most of our lives without fear that death could be around the corner. The pandemic changed that. That sense of fragility, that sense that you could get, if not die, could be made really sick in a very random way, I think really did change people's perspective on their vulnerability. And for some people, they decided that the safest course was to completely ignore it and, you know, consider everybody wusses for taking this seriously. For a lot of people, it led them to, you know, rethink what really mattered to them. And I'm seeing people make major career changes, seeing people change where they live. I'm seeing people change how they live because of what's happened in this pandemic. And I think that's going to be a lasting change.
Dr. Atul Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's also the author of Being Mortal, Medicine, and What Matters in the End. Dr. Gawande, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's now go to the place where the pandemic began, Wuhan, China. A year ago, the city of 11 million was under full lockdown. It worked. The city has not had a single reported COVID case since last May. But the experience, the isolation, fear, and death, that changed people there. The World's Rebecca Canther went to Wuhan to hear their stories.
39-year-old Wang Fan runs this cocktail bar and several other bars and restaurants in Wuhan. Before last year's lockdown, he wouldn't describe himself as much of a do-gooder. But in those scary months at the start of the pandemic, he surprised himself. It was a natural reaction, he says. When you see something happening right in front of your eyes and you can help, you do something. With his restaurants unable to open, he donated the excess food to make meals for medical workers. He took journalists around on his scooter. He knocked on doors to check on elderly people. He wasn't alone. Others in Wuhan were connecting through WeChat groups and trying to help out in whatever way they could. Some coordinated deliveries of masks and protective gear from abroad. Others donated supplies or helped patients get to the hospital. Wang Fan's friend Jiang Qi, who works as a craft brewer, was also moved to help. Most people followed orders to stay inside. But he said it felt awful to be stuck at home worrying. It was less scary to go out and do something, he says. So I started from something small. I put on protective gear and drove medical workers to the hospital. Wang Fan says that he and his friends in the restaurant business have continued to support local causes, including helping children who lost their parents to COVID. The experience of volunteering last year changed how he thinks about his role in the community. It got me involved in charitable work, he says. I think having a business means you have some obligations to society, a responsibility to help others. Once the lockdown ended in April, Wang Fan says he fell into a bit of a depression. Business was bad. After helping so many people, now he was the one in need of help. His restaurants could only do takeout. Business was just 3% of what it was normally. During the lockdown, I was always busy helping journalists or volunteering, he says. I had a lot of things to do. But once restaurants reopened, my businesses were struggling. I had a lot of bills to pay. I couldn't sleep at night. Wang Fan's friend Evan Zhou, a liquor importer, was also struggling with his business. During the lockdown, he kept busy coordinating deliveries of donated supplies and helping people get to the hospital. Once things reopened, his business was in ruins, and he was out $60,000. When I was volunteering, I spent a lot of time thinking about what I wanted to do with my life, he says. I made a decision to leave everything in Wuhan and go try somewhere new. I was sick of being stuck in one place. Here at this cocktail bar in Shanghai, Evan is meeting clients. He moved to Shanghai last spring and now works for a drinks distributor here. He says after the lockdown, a change of scenery was just what he needed. A lot of friends tell me they think I look happier here, he says. Shanghai has been less affected by the pandemic, and the economy is doing better here. I think this is the right environment for me right now. Back in Wuhan, Jiang Qi and Wang Fan have just opened up a new brew pub. It's packed with young people, eating American-style food and drinking IPA beer. The restaurant industry is still not back to what it was like before the pandemic. But the two friends are optimistic about this year. We just want to work hard and enjoy our lives, Jiang Qi says. Wang Fan says he's been spending much more time with his parents. He says even those people who didn't lose a loved one to COVID have a kind of PTSD. The wound is healing, he says. We'll never forget that time, but it's not as painful now as it was before. But it's like a scar. It will never go away. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
An international effort to share vaccines globally is picking up speed. The COVAX initiative announced plans this week to get more than 330 million vaccine doses to developing nations in the first half of the year. Here's the thing, that will cover less than 4% of the population of the countries on the receiving end. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is a former president of Liberia and a Nobel Peace Prize laureate. She co-chairs the pandemic review panel at the World Health Organization, and Sirleaf warns the COVAX countries need to do more.
If they do not respond to the needs in Africa so that everyone has access in a reasonable period of time, they can be assured that they will also not be safe. This is an interdependent and interconnected world. They have to see vaccine as a global good to be able to save humanity, and humanity is worldwide. They cannot treat it as apartheid. It cannot say because you're poor, you will not be vaccinated. Only the rich will be.
Madam President, it strikes me that that message is going to have to move fast and acted upon quickly, because it seems we've been talking about the inequities of who the pandemic impacts since the beginning of the pandemic and the vaccine inequity not long after. What will happen in the next year or so if wealthy countries continue to monopolize the vaccine supply?
If they do not protect the entire world population, COVID-19 is going to continue and will perhaps become even more deadly. They will not be able to stop the spread of this disease if they do not also secure for all the countries of the world.
Last month, you were very vocal in expressing your concern about collective leadership failures at the WHO at seemingly every turn during this pandemic. Since then, what signs have you seen that the global community is responding to this concern?
Let me just put an example of the change in the United States. Well, we see the Biden administration has done all it can to reverse negative actions that were taken by the former administration. And they have committed themselves to give full support to the WHO, to give the full funding, as had been the case before. We're seeing now that countries are now discussing about the COVAX facility, and more people are making financial commitments to this facility that will be able to purchase the vaccine for countries. Many countries, too, have been offering vaccines to countries. And some of it has to come from, you know, their own supply, but in which they think that they can address the most vulnerable. We see discussion going on right now in the Development Finance Institution, the World Bank, the IMF, the African Development Bank. But the vaccines are still held, you know, by the pharmaceutical companies, by the rich countries, and until they agree on the equity and then put these entities to work, we cannot leave Africa or any other poor country behind. This world is one world. Through travel, through interconnections of every kind, communication, and there is no one that can be safe in any powerful, rich country of the world if you leave the poor countries behind, if they do not get vaccines, if they do not get responses in building proper preventions through their national healthcare system. And you can be assured that if another pandemic comes, it will not be those who now have vaccines and are vaccinated that will be safe.
Well, you've been especially outspoken about worries that COVID-19 vaccines will not be widely available in much of Africa until 2022 or even 2023. Why does sub-Saharan Africa seem to be at the back of the line?
Well, you know, vaccines are dictated by resources and authority and power. The rich nations have been able to buy the vaccines. They provided the research for the vaccines, and it's just commercial forces and resources.
So are you saying that until those things change, sub-Saharan countries and the less wealthy nations of the world are just always going to come last?
No, I'm not saying exactly that. What I am saying is that right now, the richer countries have the resources. They are buying the vaccines. They are ensuring that their citizens get vaccinated first. Some of them have reached out. There are countries with resources that are trying to buy it. I think South Africa may be able to get 1 million vaccines, you know, through their own purchase. Some countries have been giving a limited supply to address particular health workers who are vulnerable. And so will it take 22, 23? We hope not. Just remember, and we want the world to remember, that vaccine has to be a public good.
Former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf co-chairs the World Health Organization's Pandemic Review Panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here at The World, we're keeping an eye on the vaccine rollout around the globe. For more of our reporting on the pandemic, head to theworld.org/coronavirus. If you tune in regularly, you've heard us talking about carbon offsets, reducing or offsetting your greenhouse gas pollution by taking action like paying to plant trees or financing solar wind farms. This idea has gained a lot of popularity as a climate change solution, but as we reported last week, offsets can have some drawbacks. Today, though, we flip the script and look at their promise on our weekly climate change solution segment, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Today, our focus is Eastern Canada and a project aiming to save some of the forest there. Here's The World's Anna Kusmer.
Patricia Amiro bought 32 acres of land in rural Nova Scotia around 10 years ago, not long after the forest had been cut down for timber. Now the trees are growing back.
Red spruce, eastern hemlock, eastern white pine, red oak, yellow birch, red maple.
She likes walking among them and spotting birds.
Bald eagle, we also have sharp-shinned hawks. We have red-tailed hawks. We have a lot of different hawks.
Amiro
also
is a forestry expert who helps landowners in eastern Canada manage their forests.
For us, it's highly recreational, in a sense, spiritual. You know, we're not churchgoers by any means, but our church is the woods.
A lot of what she does is help people decide where and when to cut trees to sell for timber. But she says a lot of landowners would actually like money to not cut down their trees.
Get paid in some fashion for maintaining a forest and all the values that it has, getting, you know, paid for basically storing carbon and maintaining carbon over a certain period of time.
That's where Community Forests International comes in. It's an organization that wants Canadian companies to help pay to protect forests in the Eastern Maritime Provinces. Zach Melanson is a co-founder.
We see forest offsets as a mechanism or as a way to provide these landowners with an incentive to leave trees, to manage sustainably,
Over the past decade, they've partnered with 10 family forest owners to create carbon management plans. That means encouraging the growth of certain trees and selective tree cutting to help the forest store more carbon. The funding for the project comes from companies who want to offset their emissions.
We've worked with companies mostly in the larger financial centers, so Toronto and Vancouver, to basically make their carbon footprints tangible in trees.
Canada's carbon pricing system is getting more strict, which is expected to increase demand for offsets across the country. So Melanson's organization hopes to expand in the coming years to work with hundreds of landowners.
The model would be that basically people would sign on to a contract, maybe 5, 10, 15 years, and that contract would stipulate how they need to manage their forests.
Offsets projects around the world have been plagued with issues in the past. It can be hard to track how much carbon is actually being stored when companies buy offsets across national borders. And many projects are contested by local people who rely on forests for farming or timber. But experts say this project could be a better model. It's easier to track the carbon arithmetic within one country, and there's less potential for conflict when you have private landowners preserving their own forests. The money flowing to rural areas gives private landowners who control nearly half of the forests in the Maritimes an alternative to clearing for timber. Tom Beckley, a forestry expert at the University of New Brunswick, says the status quo is clear cutting, but this project could help change that.
You know, hopefully break out of that cycle and figure out a way to create revenue streams for landowners that don't involve that kind of liquidation mindset.
Community Forests International's forest plan also helps people plan for climate change by selecting for trees that thrive in warmer temperatures or drought. So from a forestry perspective, this project is great, says Beckley. But when I asked him about the climate perspective, he said I should talk to his partner.
When your email first came in, I showed her your questions and I said, this might be for you more than me.
Her name is Louise Comeau.
I am a climate activist, researcher, and communicator, educator.
Also at the University of New Brunswick. Comeau says offsets are a sort of niche solution.
Offsets, by default, will always be extremely tiny.
They only really help if industry is simultaneously working on drastically reducing their emissions. And Comeau said they could backfire.
In the short term, while we're in a emergency, we don't see any additional reductions coming from industry if they just use offsets.
Comeau worries that companies will delay emissions cuts because they feel like offsets give them a free pass. Joseph Pallant is a climate policy expert at EcoTrust Canada, who sees offsets pretty differently.
The present day status quo is the free pass. Not buying an offset is the free pass.
He says forest offsets are a tool to invest in real emissions reductions.
To be supporting a smallholder in the Maritimes to keep their family forest standing rather than cutting it. These are not get out of jail free. These are creating the world that we want to see happen. And that happens from offsets.
Ultimately, Patricia Amiro from Nova Scotia says she supports the idea of companies pitching in to pay forest owners like her to preserve their land. And not just companies.
Everyone in society benefits from these forests. So, like, it's almost like, shouldn't everyone pay for that, you know, or contribute in some way for the wide range of contributions that forests make to the world?
Those benefits are real. Forests remove nearly a third of global CO2 emissions every year from the atmosphere. The challenge is creating a system that values them. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
This is the ensemble Zidasha and a song titled Shepherd of Nature. Sticking with the environmental theme, Zidasha is based in the Caucasus in Georgia, a polyphonic choir, very traditional there. But Zidasha is one of the rare choirs in Georgia that is mixed, male and female, and led by women.
Oh,
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Online 24/7 at theworld.org. Stay safe, be strong. I hope you can make it back here tomorrow.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld. From P.